as these conditions began to pile up, what actions did our government take and the market take in order to try to right the ship?
Well, so, you know, let me address the first part of your comment there. So you're right, you know, it was really hard for regular people in a lot of different ways, because on the one hand, you're losing your home. On the other hand, you're seeing your savings, your wealth completely wiped out. And that can't be easy. And then at the same time, getting loans is hard because there was a complete tightening of the credit market. So getting loans wasn't easy. So even though the Federal Reserve was injecting money into the economy, banks were so scared to lend out money. There was a complete credit crunch. So there was a complete tightening of the market. Banks were completely scared of lending money. And so, you know, Anna Schwartz, who's an economist, said that it's not really a liquidity crisis. It's more of a crisis of trust at this point. So the Great Recession, in a lot of ways, could be termed as a crisis of trust rather than a liquidity crisis, because the Federal Reserve did inject a lot of money. And I think in a lot of ways, that's something that we still haven't repaired. And that's something that we still didn't address. So that answers your second question to some degree, that, you know, there are things that that the Federal Reserve did do. One of the things that they did was lower the interest rate, and which they do by injecting money into the economy. So that's by increasing the money supply. So they lowered the federal funds rate, and that they lowered that to almost near 0%, to about a quarter of a percentage. And so that was one of the things that they did. The other thing that they did was they actually lent money to more than just banks. So typically, traditionally, the Federal Reserve would only lend out money to commercial banks, but they opened up their window. It's actually known as a discount window, but they actually opened up their bank window to more than just commercial banks. So they actually started lending out to more than just the traditional financial institutions. And we also started seeing tax rebates, and both during the Bush administration and the Obama administration, we saw $168 billion stimulus and then the $787 stimulus. We saw the increase of the FDIC coverage, so which is when you open a bank account, your bank will tell you that in case the bank fails, in case there is a bank run or a bank failure, the Federal Deposit Insurance Company would come and bail out the bank. So the FDIC basically increased that coverage as well. We also had the TARP funds for the Troubled Asset Relief program for banks as well. So those are some of the those are some of the policy responses that we had.
So that's it. Really is an example of where government policies did come in, mm-hmm. and, you know, virtually save the economic system.
Yes. So those were some government policies that happened. In addition to that, we actually had some regulations that were put in place, we could talk a little bit about that if you like. So some of those regulations were putting restrictions on shadow banks. So one thing that is important to understand is that the crisis that we had was actually related to banks that are of the nature of not traditional commercial banks. So they were financial institutions that don't perform the job of your regular commercial banking institutions. So those are called shadow banks. And so we have a lot of restrictions and regulations on commercial banks, but we don't have a lot of restrictions and regulations on commercial banks. And so the idea was to put some restrictions and regulations on shadow banks. So, for example, restricting their size. You might have heard the term too big to fail.
Yep.
So, if the point is that if they're too big to fail, maybe they're too big after all, right? So... And if they are too big, then maybe they should be holding more capital. Maybe they should have more capital, or maybe they shouldn't be too big after all. And you know, reducing the amount of risk that they are taking. And just making sure that the regulations, there's more coordination amongst different regulatory bodies. We have a lot of regulatory bodies in the United States, but there's just lack of coordination among them. And that's essentially what was known as the Dodd-Frank Act. So all of this that I just mentioned, all of these regulations.
So when did things start to turn around? When did we start seeing, you know, some return on the investment, so to speak, on some of these policy changes?
You know, the unemployment rate stayed at 10% for a very long time. And, you know, the recession technically ended in 2009. But the unemployment rate did not reach its peak even until a few years later. And it took a long time before the unemployment rate started falling. And part of the reason is that there was a lot of uncertainty in the economy even after the recession ended. So firms started recovering from the recession. They started producing more output, but they preferred hiring machines rather than hiring workers in order to produce more output. So they were more reluctant to hire workers because it's easier to get rid of a machine rather than it is to get rid of a worker. So that was one of the reasons why it was so hard for people to find jobs. And because there was just so much uncertainty in the economy. And for businesses to invest in the economy was also very hard because, like I mentioned earlier, it was really hard for people, for small businesses, for whether it's large businesses or small businesses, to get loans because banks were just really scared.
Now, I would think that we learned a lot from going through this and would hopefully not make the same mistakes. But, you know, like right now we're seeing, you know, markets just booming other than, you know, recently with some market correction. But, you know, we're seeing same kind of, you know, accelerated growth that makes people wonder, wait a minute, okay, what's going on? How could this be growing this fast, this soon? And are worried for that other shoe to drop, you know, and we don't want a repeat of 2008. Where are we right now is, you know, with, you know, all the regulations and stuff that were put in 10 years ago and shortly after that, are they working and that's why we're seeing so much improvement, or are we ignoring them, or has markets changed to where they're not really relevant anymore?
It is a little bit hard to tell, but there are concerns that all that money that was injected into the economy, there is going to be a little bit of backlash from that because the Federal Reserve did inject a lot of money into the economy and kept the interest rate really low. And so that might have some backlash on the economy. You know, it's been 10 years that the interest rate was so low. And so one of the side effects of that might be high inflation rate in the future. And that was one of the concerns that brought down the stock market a little bit in the last couple of weeks. That's one of the side effects that's expected. Another one that is expected is that right now the Federal Reserve has a really bloated balance sheet. They bought a lot of assets, a lot of financial assets. And they might have to eventually get rid of those. And they have all these assets that they don't typically hold. And there are concerns there are other bubbles that might burst in the future. One of them, of course, is the student debt crisis. There are nearly 40% of student debt holders who have already defaulted on loans. That's one area where we expect a crisis. Another area where we expect a crisis is the auto loan market. We actually have a similar situation going on in the auto loan market. There's a subprime auto loan market similar to the subprime mortgage crisis. There's a similar crisis expected in the auto loan market.
Yeah, didn't they go through something like that in the mid-90s or something? You know, I remember when auto loans all of a sudden became difficult to get back when they were, for a while there, they were real easy.
Yeah, it is. You know, right now we are seeing a big supply in autos, but in cars, but not a lot of demand for it.
Yeah, well, not a lot of demand for vehicles that cost $40,000. I mean, they're going to, you know, I've been looking at that as something that's going to have to hit us eventually, because once you start pricing out the average American worker who can no longer afford a new vehicle, mm-hmm. or where their vehicle is going to be more than their mortgage payment, that can't be sustainable.
And you're also looking at a generational change here. You're looking at a generation that doesn't want to buy cars that frequently. They don't want to change cars that frequently, especially in urban areas where people just prefer taking Uber everywhere. Or, you know, you're also looking at cars that last 300,000 miles or 400,000 miles. People are just not going to want to buy cars that frequently. Just to give you an example, in 2016, U.S. car makers gave more in discounts than they pay to their workers. That's something to think about.
So here's a question, because we, you know, during this whole interview, and we really haven't addressed any kind of politics or the, you know, political climate with and how it affects things. Just have, you know, anybody that's lived through this, you know, mm-hmm. they, you know, from, you know, George W. Bush being blamed for the entire economic meltdown, for President Obama being, you know, blamed at the beginning and then, you know, praised as the one who saved everything, to Trump being taking a lot of credit of himself for the market bounding back, but then also, you know, people are ready to blame him in case it all boils down. So how much effect does, you know, does politics, and especially in those higher level offices, really have an effect on the, you know, all of these things that we talked about, and the, you know, the market fluctuations, the growth, and the bursting of bubbles? Are we correctly assigning blame and credit when we do that?
You know, ultimately, the blame lies in everybody. Everybody has to take blame a little bit. You know, if you look at who's to take blame for the crisis, it's the Federal Reserve for keeping interest rates low for too long. Home buyers for buying houses that they shouldn't have bought. Mortgage brokers for giving out loans recklessly, just caring about their commission. Investment banks for creating these complicated securities. Rating agencies giving high ratings to these securities that they didn't understand. Regulators for not regulating the markets, for not regulating these investment banks. And then, yes, government policymakers. You know, you can think about a lot of different ways in which government policymakers can be blamed. Whether it's the creation of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that was essentially done to promote home ownership and to actually promote securitization of mortgage-based securities, to give down payments to people who couldn't afford houses, which we can argue in some ways that, you know, if they can't really afford houses, then maybe they shouldn't be buying those houses, right? And then for ending the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act was ended in 1999, which separated the commercialization and the investment banking function of houses. For example, you mentioned that you got your loan from Wells Fargo. And, you know, Wells Fargo in the past would have to separate their commercial banking function from investment banking function. But now those functions can be performed together.
So going forward, you know, this, if you're, say, like your average person like myself, I consider myself an average person, and then, you know, I'm actually entering into the market right now with some investments, and, you know, it's a first opportunity that I've had to be able to plan a future and start, you know, worrying, you know, concerning myself about retirement in 20 years. And so I'm starting in these, you know, to put my money on the line, you know, as much as anybody else is now. What are some things that somebody like me can, you know, should be wary of, and can I do anything to protect myself?
Well, one thing that I would recommend is always keep yourself educated and keep yourself informed of what's going on in the economy. And, you know, one thing that we were discussing before the program started is always be mindful that the next recession is just around the corner. and be prepared, and always save money and diversify.
All right. Dr. Latika Gupta, it's been a pleasure. I learned a lot. And we're going to, of course, put this up on KeyMineralReport.com if you want to be able to review this and let us know what you think as well. So thanks so much for coming on the program.
Thank you.
Copper Country Today, we'll be right back.